My name is Jackie Lamport. Today is Wednesday, January 26th. Welcome to the Capital Daily Podcast. Today on the show,
we need to be able to, in a sense, answer all of those parts which are like a little Russian doll of questions. How many species? How do they interact?
Biodiversity loss has been called one of the top five threats confronting humanity. Three researchers from the University of Victoria are part of a team working to stem the tide against future mass extinction. Today, we find out more about the project, where they're at, and what their search can tell us about life on Vancouver Island. Today's Capital Daily Podcast is brought to you by the Belfry Theatre. This February, the Belfry will premiere Kevin Loring's new comedy, Little Red Warrior and His Lawyer, a wickedly funny satire about power, procreation, and land claims. All performances feature pay-what-you-want tickets. For tickets or more information, please visit belfry.bc.ca. That's belfry.bc.ca. It's a topic as big as they come. How do we preserve life as we know it on our planet? That's part of the focus of the global project Bioscan. They've just won a $24 million research grant. The project involves over 1,000 researchers, and three of them are from the University of Victoria. To find out the answers to the big questions about preserving life and more, podcast co-producer Martin Bauman sat down with one of those researchers, Professor David Castle.
David, thanks for joining the show.
Well, thanks for having me. It's a delight.
Let's begin with this. Just what exactly is Bioscan?
Well, Bioscan is it's a global initiative that has its basis in Canada. And really what it is it's a research program that tries to develop and use technologies that allow for the surveillance of biology everywhere around the world. And so what this really means is that it's using contemporary high throughput genomics techniques, so studying the DNA of organisms in a way that allows us to actually understand what species are there, how they're interacting, and then also over time to look at the way that ecosystem dynamics change over time. So it's a big initiative. And I think what we're going to talk about today is the fact that the Canadian research team has received a couple of fairly significant awards to continue this work for the next 6 years.
Yeah, it's a significant contribution, $24 million to be able to continue the ongoing work of this project. And I am curious to hear about some of the specifics you've mentioned there with regards to how actually anyone inventories life on Earth, but maybe take me back a little bit, because I understand that this project has been going on for a while. How did you become involved in it?
Well, that goes even further than Bioscan itself. But many years ago, I was a faculty member at the University of Guelph, and I had a longstanding collaborative arrangement with one of the professors in the Department of Biology, as it was at the time, a person named Dr. Paul Hebert. And Paul and I have worked on and off in different sort of collaborative modes for several decades. And he's one of Canada's most highly published and highly cited authors. And amongst other things, I think his claim to fame is that in about 2003, he and colleagues published a paper that said, if you look at all life on Earth, it's all different, sometimes in big ways, but it's also all different in very, very small ways. And sometimes that's just minute differences in the genetic code that each of these organisms actually have. And he thought, well, wouldn't it be interesting if we could differentiate organisms using the smallest amount of information possible, and then we could represent that difference in essentially what he called a DNA barcode. And so it's just like a barcode as you would see on products at a supermarket. So if you think about all of life on Earth needing to be inventoried, it'd be like taking stock at a Walmart where everything has a barcode. In the case of the work that the Center for Biodiversity Genomics, which Paul leads, has been doing, the challenge has actually been to assign the barcodes to figure out what are those minute genetic differences between the different the organisms, and inventory that and assign a unique identifier, a DNA barcode, to each species. And so that work has been going on since 2003. The Center for Biodiversity Genomics is at the University of Guelph. It's two of its own buildings. It's a big operation. And there have been various kinds of Canadian and international collaborations and major research projects ever since 2003. One of which I was involved with for several years, which was the International Barcode of Life Project, which was funded by Genome Canada over a decade ago. And my role in that was to actually understand some of the social, the economic, legal, and ethical dimensions of this work. Since I'm not a biologist, I pay attention to some of the social science issues about this work. Anyway, the collaboration has been just ongoing for many years. And, you know, in the past year and a half or so, a couple of major opportunities to apply for research funding came up. One of them, again, was the Genome Canada, and we were successful with that. And the one most recently, the Transformation 2020 award that we received and was just announced a week ago, was another one that we were obviously successful in. And so now we've actually got pretty good resources to continue this work, both the Canadian-focused work and also to help build those international linkages with other projects around the world.
I'm curious to hear where things go next. I'm also curious to hear more about the DNA barcoding. This project, though, is dealing with some pretty big questions. You know, for one, can we avoid planetary mass extinction? I mean, that's a pretty big one as far as questions go.
That's a question that's on all of our minds. There are other questions, though, that are even more basic before we get to a question like that, which is a question like, how many species are there on Earth? Mm-hmm. And there's still enormous ranges in the answers to that question. So before we even get to the question about, you know, conservation and, you know, trying to prevent a mass extinction, we don't even know what we're dealing with in terms of how many living species exist today. And so one of the more fundamental aspects of doing this kind of work is to provide an answer to that question. How many species are there? Well, nobody's really sure. We have some good guesstimates, and that way we know how much work we have to do to be able to answer that question. But then the other questions, which are the questions like, how do they interact? You know, there are lots of things that happen between species, obvious examples like pollinators and plants that they pollinate, but there are all sorts of other interactions about which we don't know very much. And we also need to understand the relationships between organisms in much more complicated situations so that we actually understand how ecosystems work. And so when we get to the big question that you raised at the beginning, like, you know, we're putting pressure on the environment, what's going to happen to biodiversity? We need to be able to, in a sense, answer all of those parts, which are like a little Russian doll of questions. How many species? How do they interact? What could we learn more about ecosystem dynamics before we really understand the main pressure points that we're putting on biodiversity? Because we know that things like habitat loss is obvious, but we don't understand some of the things that are happening where the changes are more subtle over time, and they actually require this deeper biological investigation.
So some of that stock taking comes back to this concept again of a DNA barcode and of inventorying life on Earth. How exactly do you or does the team accomplish something like that, taking stock of life on Earth?
In one respect, it resembles traditional taxonomy. And so everybody's probably, you know, got in mind's eye, you know, the kids' bugs collection, or things that would be at natural history museums, and where there are all sorts of different collections of organisms or parts thereof. And so in that respect, it's kind of the same. It starts off with the fact that you have to take some kind of a physical collection in order to be able to recover DNA from an organism to understand what it is and how it's related to other things in its environment. But where this really parts way with traditional taxonomy in the sense that there are now essentially automated techniques for being able to extract and amplify DNA from a specimen that you've taken, and then to be able to sequence the area that you're really interested in to develop the barcode, and then compare that barcode that you recover from your specimen against a library that you've started to build of other sorts of specimens. And so you could imagine if you set up they're called malaise traps, but it's essentially a light and fabric trap that you use to catch winged insects at night by attracting. If you set out in your garden or nearby park one of these traps and then started to just collect all of the things that fell into it, you would soon, if you started to take all the DNA out of these organisms, realize that actually we've accounted for a lot of these specimens. But every now and then you'll recover that DNA sequence of interest that's not in the library. And then you have to say, well, why is that? Is this something new? Are there two things that we thought were the same but are in fact different? Is it an invasive? And so on and so forth. So this is really interesting in that respect, but it gets more interesting than that, because what I just told you about was kind of the collection story that makes this kind of work look a lot like traditional taxonomy. But there are other techniques that you can use as well to essentially just get DNA out of the environment. And so you can it's generally just called environmental DNA, the idea that organisms leave traces of their having been in their environments. And sometimes you can recover environmental DNA from a water sample or sediment or from soil or a trace of something that's left on a plant or a rock. So there are ways that you can actually recover DNA from the environment. And as it turns out, in the last couple of weeks, there have been quite a number of interesting stories out about one of our colleagues on this project, Beth Clare, who works at York University, who has developed techniques for actually recovering DNA that's floating in the air. And so she can actually identify the presence of species that have been in an area where some of their DNA has actually simply become airborne because it's small enough to actually be carried in air currents. So that's the way that this work is actually done. And so there's no real magic, I guess, in the concept about collecting and analyzing things. Looks pretty traditional in that respect, but everything about the detail of how that's done is really a fantastic scientific and technological advance over what we've done in the past.
When you're talking about traces, I have the vision that this team is collecting the world's largest sample of animal poop of just different species. that's not what's happening.
That's an option. So in fact, actually, the person I mentioned before, Beth Clare, one of the things that she'd actually done for much of her, I believe it was her doctoral research and a lot of research afterwards, was she was trying to figure out the food webs that support colonies of bats. And so, biologists get up to all sorts of fun things. And so, yes, she was definitely collecting quite a bit of bat guano and analyzing the DNA that was in it, and from that being able to figure what insects they are consuming as they're flying around in their environments. And she was therefore able to create food source and food abundance webs for understanding how bat populations are fed. So you can do this kind of thing. And in fact, we're looking at a real possibility of doing this to try to understand some of the things that are happening, for example, just down the road in Sooke, because the Sooke First Nation is quite interested in actually understanding its changing environment. And they've noticed changes in the way in which some organisms are being harvested by other organisms, and we'll probably end up doing some analysis of trying to figure out which salmon are being consumed when by bears, and what are the seals consuming, and who's consuming, invasive species like the green crab, and to really try to understand what's going on there. So So yeah, you can do that kind of work, gut contents or scat. Yeah, absolutely.
Today's Capital Daily podcast is brought to you by Tressa. Come home to Midtown and live in one of Tressa's sophisticated studio, one or two bedroom homes priced from $329,000. Visit Tressa.ca to learn more about life in Midtown.
Talking about Souk earlier, I am curious about how this study and this project has implications for where we live and for Victoria, for Vancouver Island, for British Columbia, an area also rich in biodiversity from the rainforests to the ocean that we haven't fully tapped either. What does this project mean for us living here and what we might learn about our own backyard?
So one of the really interesting things about this BioScan project is that as a project, it is inherently interdisciplinary. So we have all sorts of different types of people who work in the biology end of this effort, all the way to people like me who are social science researchers, and pretty much everything in between. And the reason why I start there is that we have constructed this project with the idea that there needs to be natural and social scientific integration. And that's not just because it makes our funders happy, which it does. But the real reason that we want to do this is that we actually think that the value and impact of the knowledge that we create from this kind of work requires us to work in parallel and in a way that sort of helps each other. So that as the science teams are trying to figure out what species are there and how they're interacting, we on the social sciences team can take some of that knowledge and help to mobilize it and use it in different contexts. So whether or not, you know, we find out something new and interesting that relates to a particular conservation initiative that has policy relevance, we would take that and try to move that knowledge in the right direction. There's another element to this, which is really important, which is we can work with our scientist colleagues to be able to help direct some of the scientific effort to answer questions of social interest. And this really gets back to your question, like what difference does this make locally and in BC or in Canada? And the way that we've structured this project is that in particular, me and my colleague, Crystal Tremblay, who's in the Department of Geography at the University of Victoria, we're creating a program where we actually work with communities who are interested in and affected by, you know, biodiversity and its potential loss. And we will be trying to think about ways in which we can actually use community concerns to help to drive the scientific effort in directions that are meaningful to them. And that could be communities which are defined by, say, being farming communities. We have a strong sub-project in this effort in BioScan that's looking at soil biodiversity. And we have a private sector partner who's sustaining some of that work. But it could also be communities who are defined by their indigenous status. So that's where I go back to the example of Souk, but there will be others. But these are indigenous communities, and as First Nations, they have a particular relationship to the land and to the water that has helped define them socially and culturally over time. And they are interested in questions about their changing environment and ways to restore it to the way it once was from the standpoint of establishing culturally relevant food security, but also understanding how it should best be managed going forward. And that sets up all sorts of interesting questions about when we start to respect those interests, how does it change our views about the way that we protect lands? How do we use that information to inform land use policy, water use policies, and all of these kinds of considerations get captured in a particular kind of work, which is called natural capital accounting. So it's the idea that we look at all of the goods and services that ecosystems provide, but then we understand and interpret that through a social and culturally appropriate lens to understand what difference it makes to people who are affected by changes in their environment. And that's, so we're building essentially a a framework for doing natural capital accounting that will answer some of those questions that you were raising at the beginning about how does this impact a First Nation? How does this impact a whole region like Vancouver Island or the Pacific Northwest, Cascadia? You know, we will keep on going further out in trying to understand the relationship between changes in ecozones and the people who live in those places.
Just two more questions. You were mentioning the funding earlier. So new funding available. What happens next or what's sort of the next phase of this project?
Well, in the world of research, it's quite interesting because you write very large scale applications for funding. And we've certainly got a significant amount of resource now. But, you know, you write the application sometimes as much as 2 years, year and a half before you actually receive the funding. And then when you receive the funding, you have to get the project up and running. So we're in the get the project up and running hiring phase. And so we've been hiring project managers. We've got ads out for postdocs and graduate students because we need the people power to drive this thing. And it's also a matter of all of the partnerships that we've created with groups like Polar Knowledge Canada, for example, in Cambridge Bay, or Genome BC, other universities that are involved and that have to have, you know, contractual linkages. So there's all of this machinery that goes into running one of these large-scale research projects to get them up and running. But the substantive part of this is for us to start to build the priority lists for the kinds of biological work that we want to do, and then to really focus down on how we bring that social, economic, and cultural dimension in close alignment with the priorities for the biology work. And so we're actually really working on that right now. So it's actually quite exciting because we now are in the process of really sharpening the priorities that we said that we would start to work on if we got the award. So that's what we're doing.
Just finally, and you've been touching on this throughout our conversation, but with respect to those priorities, what is the great potential of this project as you see it, if you were to boil it down to its core, really?
Well, that's a great question. And really, for me, it comes down to two things. One is goes back actually to the question that you had before about biodiversity loss and species extinction. We have a basic knowledge gap here that we need to fill. We need to understand what's out there and how it's interacting and what the system ecosystem dynamics are like. So we have basic gaps in knowledge that we need to fill. So this is why we do research, is to answer these kinds of questions. So that's number one. Now we need the knowledge. But then for me in particular, the second question is, what is that knowledge going to do for us? And in my opinion, the most important thing it can do for us is to provide a basis and evidence for making good decisions about how we steward biodiversity. And so that could mean very well that we are going to be in situations where we want to work at a very local level to address concerns or provide answers to questions that raise opportunities for preserving and enhancing biodiversity. But it could also be at a much larger level, say, influencing provincial or Canadian policies and their implementation around biodiversity, especially with climate change pressures. And there's a whole global side to this as well, where we have partners in countries around the world who are all putting in equal, if not greater, resources than we are. And we're all trying to align our efforts to be able to identify and respond to the greatest global biodiversity challenges. So it's, to sum up, it's just part of it's create the knowledge, use the knowledge is really what I'm expressing. And I think that the time is right for us to be doing this, because I think that we've become acutely aware of the anthropogenic pressures on the environment. Some of it's about space, some of it's about utilization of nature, and some of it's about changing the dynamics of natural systems like climate change. And I think that our work now is really trying to make sure that we understand what's there and what we're doing to it before we lose it.
That was podcast co-producer Martin Bauman with University of Victoria professor David Castle. If you want to help support Capital Daily's local journalism and connect your business with our engaged and curious Greater Victoria audience of over 50,000, you can email our partnerships team at advertising@capitaldaily.ca. Thanks so much for joining us today. If you enjoyed the podcast, please leave a rating and a review, and also subscribe so that you don't miss any episodes going forward. We post new shows every Monday to Friday. My name is Jackie Lamport. This is the Capital Daily Podcast. We'll talk to you tomorrow.